From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and let's get the latest from Hawaii, where hundreds of people on Hawaii's Big Island have been ordered to evacuate their homes after the Kilauea volcano erupted yesterday. Streams of lava have been running towards populated areas. The governor has sent in National Guard troops to help. One local resident who was told to evacuate spoke with KHON-TV.
My family and my pets are safe. That's all I really care about. I mean, the rest is just stuff. So, we can make more money and get more stuff, but all my family's safe. That's the main thing.
Joining us now is Derek Malama at Hawaii Public Radio. Derek, give us the latest.
Okay, I have the latest here from the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory on the Big Island of Hawaii. And they confirm that there has been another volcanic eruption in Leilani Estates. That's the same place where an eruption took place yesterday. That's on the southeastern part of the Big Island in the Puna District.
Were people prepared for this, does it seem?
You know, all the signs of an eruption were there, but no one knew exactly when it would happen. There were hundreds of small earthquakes since last week. That's always a sign that something might happen, but scientists were not sure exactly when an eruption would take place, but it did, and it happened yesterday afternoon at around 4:30. There was, prior to that, a 5.0 magnitude earthquake in the morning at around 10:30 a.m., so a few hours later, that's when the first eruption took place.
And when we think of a volcanic eruption, like in the movies, it's coming out the top of a mountain. In this case, it would erupt, you know, far from the center, and maybe even come up through people's homes.
Right. This was. I saw one drone video. It was very close to a home. Lava erupted out of a crack in the ground, a fissure. And this sort of crooked line of lava was about 500 feet long. And it wasn't like any other eruptions that I've seen in the past here in Hawaii. In the past, the lava would move slower, and you could predict its movement. It would take days or maybe even weeks to get to its destination. But this one just sort of popped out of the fissure. And you could see orange and red lava shooting into the air. And one resident said a lava fountain was over 100 feet in the air. So this is different from anything I've seen in a while.
And when was the last time that something like this happened in Hawaii?
The last flow happened in the Puna District in 2014.
But it was not as intense as this one.
No, that was the a flow that was a lot slower, and people could, predict its movement. It wasn't like this one where, it just shot into the air like this.
That's Derek Malama at Hawaii Public Radio. Derek, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, today, President Trump is walking back attorney Rudy Giuliani's claim that Trump reimbursed his lawyer Michael Cohen for payments to an adult film star. The president said Giuliani will get his facts straight. Well, even Fox News' Neil Cavuto is taking on the president's ever-changing story, tweeting out, "That's your stink, Mr. President. That's your swamp." Femi Oke is host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi,
hello.
This Rudy Gate, they're calling it, it's really trending.
People are having conversations about getting the facts straight. And as for Neil Cavuto, if you haven't seen what he said on Fox News, have a look at Team Cavuto on Twitter, and you can see for yourself, depending on what side of the aisle you prefer, you're going to have a pretty strong reaction. Deborah Torelli on Twitter says, "I thought I was watching another show." More at Team Cavuto.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's one thing we're monitoring. But hashtag MeToo has hit the Nobel community. Let's take that up. Today we learned that the Nobel Prize for Literature has been postponed this year after sexual misconduct allegations within the Swedish Academy ranks. They select the winner. This is so rare. What else are we hearing?
The information was posted on Facebook and on Twitter from the Nobel Prize team, and they say that this 2018 Nobel Prize in Literature will probably be awarded in 2019, and they state it's because of a crisis in the Swedish Academy has adversely affected the prize. What is that crisis? Well, a husband of one of the members of the Swedish Academy is up for all sorts of assault allegations, also financial impropriety, and also perhaps leaking some of the potential names for the Nobel Prize for Literature. Such a scandal. Multiple people resigned. And so the jury is so small that the Swedish Academy says, well, one, we can't really do this with credibility. And two, we need to win back the public's trust. When this information went out there, people online were really quite shocked that the Nobel Prize for Literature would be postponed. Gianluca says that this American poison called political correctness, he's referring to the Me Too movement here, landed on the shores of Sweden. But as I just explained, it's a little bit more complicated than that, because you do really need a big enough jury in order to judge this prize. And with those multiple resignations and the way that the Swedish Academy is dealing with this, they do not feel that they're in good shape. The last time this happened was around World War One, World War Two, when the prize was postponed, and also in 1935 when the Academy didn't think any literature was good enough to win a Nobel Prize for Literature. Not a good year, perhaps.
Right. Well, okay, we'll follow that. That's amazing that they're putting up the Nobel. But I want to get to Twitter now saying that everyone that's on Twitter should change their password because of a bug. That's more than 330 users.
Million.
You know, data insecurity. So what else are they saying?
Well, the bug was an encryption bug. So basically our passwords on Twitter, they're encrypted, but they were not hiding in plain text. So basically you could just read your password, my password. It's been out there for, Robin, Twitter didn't even say how long, but they did say, consider changing your password on all the services where you've used the password. Reaction from Twitter, not great. Interesting, says SAO on Twitter, how scandalous Twitter news like their huge breach in privacy never trends on Twitter.
Okay, one thing we have to get to, because I love this story. There's a high school student in Utah, Kezia Dom. She wore a Chinese-style prom dress, and boy, she got just so attacked on social media because she's not Chinese. It was called cultural appropriation. Let's just listen to what she said on Sirius XM's The Luke Thomas Show.
My whole intent behind wearing the dress was to show that I thought it was beautiful, and it's a beautiful part of the Chinese culture. And so I guess I was frustrated that people weren't seeing it from my point of view.
But Femi, many people are on social media. Just in the seconds we have, they're supporting her.
Yes. She got lots of attacks, but from Weibo, which is Chinese Twitter, people were really, really appreciative. They said, this is a very elegant and beautiful dress. Mm. We don't mind sharing our culture with you if it looks that good. And Robin, one last thing.
Real quick.
Trending worldwide, hashtag May the 4th be with you. If you love Star Wars, you will know exactly what that means.
Oh my gosh. Well, go to hearnow.org. We'll tell you. Femi Oke of the stream on Al Jazeera. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, Facebook just wrapped up their F8 Developers Conference in San Jose, California, the company trying to take control of the narrative after months of bad press over how it handles and monetizes the personal data of its users. KQED's Sam Harnett reports on the kind of messaging Facebook's leaders were using this week.
Last June, Facebook changed its mission statement. Instead of making the world more open and connected, it became give people the power to build community and bring the world closer together. CEO Mark Zuckerberg kicked off the conference with that message.
But we also need to keep building and bringing the world closer together. Thank you for coming out today. Thank you for everything you're doing to bring people together. Have a great F8.
The conference is where Facebook unveils new products and features. This is Facebook's first major public event since the data privacy scandal erupted. The keynote speakers stuck closely to the mission statement. Within an hour and 45 minutes, they collectively said together, connect, and community 74 times.
Community, connect, community, 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 community.
They told the crowd that updates to each of Facebook's services would bring people closer together. They covered every product: Messenger, WhatsApp, Instagram, virtual reality, which Facebook is getting into, and even a new dating service unveiled at the conference.
We think video chat will be a powerful and seamless way to connect on Instagram.
But millions of businesses are also using WhatsApp to connect with customers, from clothing companies in Europe to bakeries.
We're also building features to make it easier for groups to do things together, like watch video.
We're also bringing this to the Messenger platform as well. It's going to be a really fun way for people to use augmented reality to connect with their family and friends privately and in real time.
This rhetoric is nothing new. It has deep roots in the origins of the internet. For instance, the tagline of Well, an online forum from 1985, is more community than you can shake a stick at. Jan English Lewick is an anthropologist at San Jose State University.
There can be a touch of Orwellian doublespeak when you think about large corporations using these very human words like community.
Some of the people who came up with this language, like Jerome Lanier, who was involved with creating the first VR headsets, have criticized the co-opting of these terms. VR headsets, by the way, drew the biggest applause at the conference. Zuckerberg announced that everyone there would get a free one.
Is getting a free Oculus Go to take home.
After the keynote speeches, I went to the press area to upload audio from the event. I had to log on to Facebook's conference wireless network. Even the password was in line with the conference messaging. It was all lowercase and just one word. Community. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Harnett.
The National Rifle Association convention is underway in Dallas. Red flag laws are sure to come up. These are the laws that allow guns to be temporarily taken away from someone who's considered at risk to themselves or to others. 8 states have a form of red flag law. At least 20 more are considering similar legislation. And in Colorado, the debate has become particularly urgent. In collaboration with Rocky Mountain PBS, Lee Patterson reports in a warning. Her story contains graphic sounds of a shooting.
In Denver on Monday, a pair of legislators, one Democrat and one Republican, got together at the state capitol to unveil their red flag bill. Here's the Republican, State Representative Cole Wist.
Law-abiding gun owners have nothing to fear with this legislation.
The two lawmakers were flanked by district attorneys, victims' families, mental health advocates, and law enforcement, including Sheriff Tony Spurlock, another Republican. And here, he's speaking directly to Colorado politicians.
I beg you to read this bill. What we're trying to do is save lives. And if you get in front of this, or you interfere with it, or you don't vote for it, you are not doing your job.
For many supporters of the bill, there was a focusing event, something that got them on board, something that happened here last New Year's Eve involving Sheriff Tony Spurlock's own deputies.
Who's there? Identify yourself.
Officers responded to 2 calls that night at an apartment south of Denver.
Hey, Matt, it's Zach.
Deputy Zachary Parrish is talking to a man here through a door named Matthew Reel. It's audio from an officer's body cam. Reel was known to be mentally ill. He had access to guns. He'd been harassing his family and even local police, who'd been dealing with him for months. That night, Reel was getting aggressive. He slammed the door, refused to come out. Officers believed that he might hurt himself or others in the apartment complex, so they decided to put him on an M1 hold, force him into the hospital for treatment. So they went in.
Matthew, come out!
And Reel started shooting. The officers shot back.
I got you, bro. Hey, you're okay. Look at me.
301, Adam, we need medical here now. We have one deputy down inside the apartment. I'm not getting anything from him. All of us have been hit at least once.
Reel killed Deputy Zachary Parrish and injured 4 more officers. Reel himself was also shot dead. His mother, Susan Reel, spoke to Rocky Mountain PBS. She described trying to get him help for months and months.
I mean, this was the worst outcome, was the fact that he had died and that he also killed somebody else. There should be a better way to deal with these situations so that nobody dies.
For supporters, this new bill is that better way. It's named after the deputy who was killed last New Year's Eve. The bill would allow family or law enforcement to ask a judge for an extreme risk protection order. If it's granted, the individual has to give up their guns for 6 months. Under the bill, the order is subject to a hearing within 7 days. And while the legislation has some Republican support, many lawmakers in Colorado are skeptical.
My first reaction was, this is just an attempt at gun control.
That's what State Senator John Cook thought when he first heard about red flag laws a few months ago. He's a Republican, a former sheriff, and he still has concerns.
If we just start, you know, taking guns away from people when we don't have proof or there's no due process, that's a very slippery slope.
In Colorado, anything gun-related is controversial. And pushback on this bill is starting already. A pro-gun group with more than 200,000 Facebook followers posted a message on its page right after the bill was introduced, telling people to call the bill's Republican co-sponsor, Cole Wist, and tell him to stop pushing gun control. Lawmakers here don't have much time to hash this all out. The legislative session wraps up on May 9th. For NPR News, I'm Lee Patterson.
Well, pivoting now to an iconic sound. Cream, Sunshine of Your Love, featuring Eric Clapton. But for the purposes of this next conversation, starring a Gibson guitar. Gibson was founded in 1902 in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Earlier this week, the company declared bankruptcy. Their story might not be over, but we just want to remember what the story is. We've brought in Walter Carter, owner of Carter Vintage Guitars in Nashville. For years, the in-house historian at Gibson. He's written several books on the company. And Walter, we just want to hear a little more of your thoughts on Clapton. In 1965, he bought a secondhand Cherry Sunburst 1960 Gibson Les Paul. Some would say with that he changed the sound of the guitar with John Mayall's Blues Breakers. As we listen to him, you know, bend this, your thoughts on what he did with the Gibson?
Well, he gave it an identifiable sound that became known for him as his woman tone, but it was a big fat in-your-face sound that most electric guitar players had not used prior to that.
Yeah. The guitar was stolen when he was with Cream in 66. So if anyone has it, let us know. But the company, Gibson, over 100 years old in the early days, they invented archtop guitars. Just a little more on the first couple decades of Gibson.
Well, they started in the apartment of a fellow named Orville Gibson in Kalamazoo, Michigan, in the 1890s. The earliest documented instrument is 1894. And then the company was formed in 1902 with Orville involved for only a very short time. And this was the middle of a mandolin craze. So their first big instruments were mandolins. And in fact, the name of the company was the Gibson Mandolin Guitar Manufacturing Company. Yeah. As popular taste changed, they started making banjos in the late teens without much success initially. They tried to revive the mandolin market in the 20s and failed, and so began concentrating more on guitars as the guitar became more popular. Through the years, they were often late to the dance with innovative and new styles of guitars, but they were able to catch up. And as we used to say when I was in the newspaper business and we got beat on a story by our rival, our task was to take the story away from the other paper with better coverage. And Gibson essentially did that with electric guitars, with acoustic flat-top guitars, and later with electric solid bodies.
And, of course, the Gibson Company united with guitar god Les Paul. We mentioned the Gibson Les Paul. Here's a little of his The World's Waiting for the Sunrise. Walter, how important was Les Paul and the Les Paul guitar to Gibson?
Well, Les was the most popular guitar player at the time of his association with Gibson. That's why they enlisted him. They were once again behind in this new market that Fender had established for solid body electric guitars. Les was one of the biggest proponents of the solid body, as well as a very popular player. He put them on the map with this new type of guitar. And one of the greatest ironies in the whole music business is that virtually no one ever bought a Les Paul guitar so that they could play like Les. You know, all the quintessential sound of the Les Paul guitar is completely foreign to the sound of Les Paul himself. He was a hot jazz-oriented player, jazz and pop, rather than a blues-based player, which was the base of all the rock and roll that was played on Les Paul guitars.
I just want to touch on a couple other moments in Gibson history. For instance, the Andy Griffith theme played on a 1924 Gibson L5 acoustic archtop. So there was one sound, and then, of course, as we started with the big rock and roll guys, 70s and 80s, who used Gibsons, AC/DC, Led Zeppelin, Guns N' Roses. And Walter Carter, Gibsons, also incredible collector items. How crazy is the scene right now as Gibson, the company, is looking at bankruptcy? They'll still be around, probably, but what's happening in the collector scene?
Well, there are plenty of Gibsons out there and always have been. As you can tell from the Andy Griffith Show theme, that's still a viable guitar, even though that recording was made 30 or more years after the guitar was made. And I've played that particular guitar. Huh. It's still a viable guitar. And that's the case with most guitars by not only by Gibson, but all of the good guitar makers through the years. There hasn't been much significant in the way of advances in guitar design in the last 50 years. So all of those old guitars are still viable. They're still out there. I don't think Gibson's bankruptcy declaration has really affected the market for new or used Gibsons yet.
We got to let you go, but as we listen to more of the Gibson, what's it like to play one?
Oh, it's like driving a nice car, you know, a high-end car. You don't realize what kind of difference there is if you've been driving a cheap car until you drive something that's good. And it's the same with Gibson and also with the other top-tier guitar makers. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of quality and craftsmanship, and it's hard to discount the legacy and just the feeling that you're playing something that's been a part of American culture for so long.
Yeah. Walter Carter, former in-house historian at Gibson, now owner of Carter Vintage Guitars in Nashville, Tennessee. Walter, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
The unemployment rate has fallen to its lowest level since 2000, 3.9%. That's according to the Labor Department report today. The economy also added 164,000 jobs in the month of April. And there have now been 91 straight months of job growth, one of the longest expansions on record. Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. He joins us now. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So first of all, I guess when you look at that unemployment rate, 3.9%, you'd have to call this a pretty strong jobs report. What's behind it?
Well, the U.S. just continues to have this somewhat slow but very reliable and steady economic growth that really hasn't overheated to the point where companies have been too aggressive in hiring and then need to lay off. And the main reason for that is, interest rates have picked up a little bit lately, but historically they're still very low compared with history. And the recent tax cuts also are helping companies, giving them that extra confidence to keep the job growth going.
But that number, 164,000 jobs added in April, was actually lower than what economists were expecting, right?
It was. It was a little lower than expected. Then again, the March number was revised higher by about 30,000, so 30-some thousand. So it's not too huge of a—
Well, and this one may be revised higher or lower next month. They always change these things.
Yep.
The African-American unemployment rate fell to 6.6%, which is the lowest level since 1972.
Right. Well, and possibly even longer than that. Remember, that's when the data goes back to 1972 on that metric. So it's the lowest in the data we have in history. And it's interesting to look at the jobs report and see what categories of jobs saw the best growth. They're very interesting and somewhat encouraging. Professional and business services, for example, added about 54,000 jobs. They've added about 500,000 over the past year. So that's, a good sector of mostly well-paying jobs with good pay and benefits. And elsewhere, manufacturing, mining, and healthcare all saw decent jobs growth. So some good industries to see growth in.
And part of the reason why the unemployment rate fell is that people are leaving the labor force. The number of people employed or looking for work fell 0.1 percentage point to 62.8. Why are people leaving the labor force?
Well, so it's important to remember this is a number, labor force participation, that actually peaked in the year 2000 and has been steadily going down. It hit the lowest since the 1970s in 2015. And then it's kind of stabilized where it is here. So, yeah, it's up or down at any given month. But over the last few years, it's been pretty stable. And there's a lot of debate about this. You know, the government gives you the numbers, but not a lot of color on the explanation. I think one big thing is that when it peaked earlier in the century, you could almost look at that as when the baby boomers were, you know, raising kids, sending them to college, and really needed two members of the couple working. And now that they're sort of over that hump, some of the older members of the prime age working force are falling out of the labor force.
And what about wages, Mike?
So the wage growth was a little bit disappointing. Year over year, it was up 2.6%, down a little bit from 2.7% in the prior month. And it's kind of a conundrum for economists, because when the unemployment rate gets this low, you would expect those wages to pick up, but they haven't quite yet. So there's a lot of debate about it. People think that in this particular economic cycle, due to things like technology and inflation not being that strong, that it might even have to go a little bit lower before its wages start picking up more.
That's Mike Regan at Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Ocular melanoma, an eye cancer, is rare. It typically affects 6 out of every 1 million people. But doctors have found dozens of patients with ties to either Huntersville, North Carolina, or Auburn, Alabama, or both, many of whom attended Auburn University between 1983 and 2001. At least 3 of them were friends. One of them, Julie Green, 27 when she was diagnosed, told CBS News that she went to her doctor after she began seeing flashes of light.
He said, there is a mass there. There's something there. I don't know what it is. It looks like it could be, you know, a tumor. I mean, it's like you had just had the breath knocked out of you.
More money is needed for further research, but initial crowdsourced information shows many of those affected are also women. Some were in neighboring sororities at Auburn. Patients have put together a Facebook page. The numbers are growing as people across the country realize they were also in the areas during those years and now have ocular melanoma. It's a medical mystery, and Marlena Arloff is one of the doctors trying to solve it. She's an oncologist at the Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Jefferson Health in Philadelphia. Dr. Arloff, do we have any idea why these cases are connected to these two areas?
No, we don't. And certainly that's, you know, obviously why there's some ongoing investigations. You know, we see this cancer every day. So even though the cancer is quite rare, it's not necessarily rare to us. However, whenever I meet a patient, I always ask them if they know anyone with the cancer. And very commonly, the answer is no. I don't know anyone with this cancer. I didn't know you could get melanoma in your eye. So obviously, you know, to our surprise, we're really dealing with these two situations now where there's a number of people in the same community who have this rare cancer who know each other.
Are you calling it a cluster?
So we're not calling it a cluster, and that's really because the term cluster is really a term from epidemiology. And in order to really classify something as a cluster, you need to have what's called an observed incidence higher than the expected incidence. So really for any disease, you would look to an area and look and see what the expected incidence would be. And then if your observed incidence is higher than that, then you could potentially call it a quote-unquote cluster. But for a number of reasons, we've not been able to prove that in these two situations. Part of the reason is because not all of the patients were living in the state at the time of diagnosis. Some have to do with the fact that they were diagnosed out of state and the cases might have not made it back, or in a lag time in reporting. So unfortunately, we have not been able to really statistically prove that these are quote-unquote clusters. However, we do think that the accumulations are of interest.
Well, concerning. And the numbers keep climbing, so yes, that term cluster might yet come. But we know, for instance, as we said, 3 of the patients were in the same or neighboring sororities at Auburn University. And we're all education majors. Are you thinking about perhaps environmental factors?
Of course. I mean, I think any time that you see a rare cancer or rare disease happening in a very tight geographic area, and we toured Auburn University and we saw where these girls lived, and even if they weren't specifically in the same exact dorm, you know, they were right adjacent to each other and on the college campus. So whenever you see that, you do question, is there some sort of environmental factor here? So certainly exploring that is on the top of our list.
Any sense that this might be tied to tanning or sunbathing?
We don't think so. And I would say that for a number of reasons. Number one, I think people want to think that because it's melanoma. And we know that tanning bed use and UV exposure can certainly increase risk of skin melanoma. And certainly when you talk about women, you talk about some kind of behaviors like tanning bed use. However, if it were something as simple as the sun or as simple as tanning bed use, we wouldn't necessarily, I think, be seeing it in these such restricted geographic right. locations. And I think it would be way more common than what we're seeing. And there's also a decent body of literature suggesting that UV exposure isn't really the story, or at least the whole story. So we do not really think that that is what we're looking for. You know, there may be another culprit, and it may be UV plus something, but I think just tanning bed use or UV light alone or history of sunburns or anything like that is not really the cause at this time.
Well, remind us, we think of melanoma, obviously, as skin cancer. What is ocular melanoma, and what are the symptoms?
Yeah, so ocular melanoma, eye melanoma as it's called, and really in this case, we should be really calling it uveal melanoma, which is a melanoma that can involve three parts of the eye called the choroid, the ciliary body, and the iris, is very rare and much different from skin melanoma. Skin melanoma, anywhere from 80,000 to 100,000 cases diagnosed annually. Uveal melanoma, we're talking about 2,000 to 2,500 cases. And they are very different diseases. You know, what I often tell patients is, other than the fact that they look the same under the microscope, they actually behave very, very differently. Patients with uveal melanoma, oftentimes, their presentation is with visual disturbance or retinal detachment symptoms, such as flashes, floaters, and blurry vision. Other patients have no symptoms at all, and the tumor may be picked up on routine eye exam.
Which is why it's a good idea to have a routine eye exam. But
always.
Yeah, but how do you treat it? We know one of the patients, at least, had to have her eye removed. So how do you treat it?
So, yeah, so patients will, like I said, present with those symptoms and be evaluated by an ocular oncologist. Most patients will get radiation therapy to the eye. However, patients with really large tumors or tumors that are really involving the optic nerve or are painful will get their eye removed, something called enucleation. Mm-hmm. But enucleation is actually far more rare these days, and most patients get away with radiation.
And it can travel to other parts of the body. We know one patient we're reading about has now had to deal with cancer in other parts of the body. Is ocular melanoma fatal?
So up to, even though the primary treatment of the eye is very effective, and most times the cancer does not come back in the eye, up to about half of patients can recur with a distant spread of the disease at a later date. The most common site that we see the cancer turn up, most often within the first kind of 3 to 5 years, is in the liver. And once the disease metastasizes to the liver, there is no cure. We have a number of treatments that can prolong life, including liver-directed therapy, some immunotherapies, certainly certain therapies in clinical trial. However, the disease is often life-threatening.
Okay, so this is scary. And we're imagining people in Huntersville, North Carolina, and Auburn, Alabama, are nervous about this. Do you know, have you seen, has there been an uptick in screenings?
So in North Carolina, which is really where the investigation started, in an effort to assist the public with kind of awareness of the disease and really just, you know, making sure that they were aware, that we were aware of what was going on, North Carolina actually offered free eye exams about a year ago. And there was an increased number of people being screened, but there was not an increased number of eye melanomas found.
Well, there's now a Facebook group to connect people. So if our listeners across the country are hearing this and have this same cancer, they may want to jump on there. We'll link them at herenow.org to share what these patients are learning. And how about you as one of the doctors on the team? Yes, a mystery I know you want to solve, a puzzle you want to put together. But how else is this hitting you?
So, yeah, I mean, you know, I think one of the more unique things, again, about this is that this is really young women. You know, we talk about the median age of this disease being about 60, and certainly we do see that age population. But certainly in the Huntersville, North Carolina group, two of the young girls who were kind of first diagnosed, both went to the same high school, diagnosed in their 20s, you know, died in their 30s, mm-hmm. Died at a young age. And so it is tough. It's tough to see, you know, all these people who are connected in some way, you know, dealing with this very, very difficult disease. However, I think part of me feels that even if we don't find anything that really truly connects all of the cases, at the very least, we're bringing awareness to this disease and hopefully some additional funding for research regarding not just the investigations, but ongoing research and trying to treat the more advanced cases, which this really orphan disease desperately needs.
That's Dr. Marlena Orloff, an oncologist at the Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Jefferson Health in Philadelphia. Dr. Orloff, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And we will follow this story again. What a mystery.
This week, the U.S. Energy Information Administration reported that U.S. oil production rose to a record level in February, and yet the price of oil continues to go up. It's nearly $70 a barrel. Joining us now is Phil Flynn, an energy market analyst at Price Futures Group in Chicago. Phil, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be back in this crazy time in the oil market.
Well, and the oil prices are relatively high right now. I mean, compared to where they have been in the past couple of years, down around $26 a barrel. Now we're up near 70. What is going on? What's influencing that?
You know, more than anything, this is a good story to tell. It's really about a strong global economy. We're seeing record demand for oil around the globe. And here in the United States, the economy is hitting on all cylinders. You know, unemployment is low, gasoline demand's at a record high for this time of year, and that's all reflective of people feeling better about the economy. And when they feel better about the economy, that means that jobs are being created and companies are using more oil, and that really drives demand.
Okay, so strong demand around the world. What about the tensions in the Middle East? How much is that playing into the price?
I think it is playing into it a great deal. And, you know, recently, of course, the fear that we may put sanctions back on Iran, it really caused the market to rally. When Benjamin Netanyahu basically said Iran is lying about their nuclear program, Donald Trump needs to do the right thing and sanction these countries, that drove oil prices higher. And what's different about today than where we were, say, a couple of years ago, the global supplies have fallen dramatically in the last couple of years. So we don't have the type of oil cushion that we've had in the past that would keep prices stable if there is some type of a disruption.
Even though U.S. oil production hit a record this year?
Yes, rising oil production is historic. It's great. But it basically is not going to replace some of the reduced investment for oil production in other places around the world.
Like where?
For example, in Russia, in China, even in OPEC countries. And when oil prices broke a few years ago, major oil companies stopped investing big amounts to find more oil and produce more oil. And globally, production is actually falling from where it was just a year ago. It's fallen over 4%, even with the historic rise in U.S. production.
Now, there are many countries around the world that love it when oil prices go up, including Saudi Arabia. What are they doing to try to increase the price?
Well, they definitely have conspired, OPEC and non-OPEC countries. Russia, for example, got together a few years ago and said, hey, guess what, guys? We're going to withhold oil from the market to try to get rid of oversupply. Basically, they were running a victory lap a month ago saying, hey, you know, the global oversupply, you know, the biggest oil glut of all time, guess what? It's gone.
And what about a country like Venezuela, which is in such an economic catastrophe right now? And part of that has been because the price of oil has been low. Are they likely to see some benefit from a rising price?
No, and it's too bad. I think if you look at the history of the oil market and you look at the history of Venezuela, they squandered one of the greatest opportunities that oil-producing countries had over the last few years. And right now, sad to say, I don't see a lot of hope that Venezuela can turn their oil industry around, you know, unless there's a change in leadership.
Here in the United States, you say that demand for gasoline is high right now. What does this rising oil price mean for the price at the pump?
We're going to see prices continue to go up. Anybody that's filled up their gas tank over the last couple of months realizes that prices have gone up almost every day for the last 30 days. Now, the good news is that once we get past Memorial Day, prices have a tendency to level off. Mm. You know, in the past, when we saw gasoline prices rise, you know, we would see demand pull back a little bit. And so far, we haven't had any evidence that American drivers are pulling back. So what that tells me is that even though prices are going up, because most people are working and they're making a little bit more money, they're adjusting to the higher prices. They don't like them. It's taking money out of their pocket. But we're not seeing a major change in their behavior. For example, we're seeing the sales of SUVs and poor fuel-efficient vehicles really sell very strongly. Mm-hmm. You don't see a big movement to get to Priuses and electric cars right now. And that's really a sign that, you know, the U.S. driver is feeling pretty confident about the economy and feeling pretty confident that they're going to be able to afford these higher gasoline prices.
So make your prediction, Phil Flynn. How high are oil prices going to go this year?
Well, I think in the next couple of weeks, we could see oil prices in the United States above $70. We'll probably level off at that point. But by the end of the year, there is a high likelihood that we will see oil prices get up near $80 a barrel.
That's Phil Flynn, an energy market analyst at Price Futures Group in Chicago. Phil, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And Here It Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here It Now.